And we're coming up here on 9:30 p.m. at WNUR FM, Evanston, Chicago, 89.3 FM, Chicago's Sound Experiment. And this is Media Geek, media freedom, and our right to communicate. A weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. Media Geek is online at MediaGeek.net. It's home to the Media Geek blog. I'm easing back into updating more than once every 12 days. Oh, blogs, they're difficult. And the radio show is at radio.mediageek.net, where you can, of course, download the program, listen to your browser, or subscribe to the podcast and get automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. If you have any comments about the program, if you have any questions tonight, send them off to me, mediageek@gmail.com, or go to the Twitter feed if you're one of those 140-character writers. Writing your epic novel, two lines at a time, twitter.com/MediaGeek. And tonight we're speaking with Daniel Gilfillan. His new book is Pieces of Sound, German Experimental Radio. And it's out on the University of Minnesota Press, available in paperback. Certainly, you can find it online, and you will probably find it at better bookstores everywhere. And Daniel is an associate professor of German studies in the School of International Letters and Cultures at the Arizona State University. So we've been talking about this development of radio in Germany, starting out as experimental, as a two-way medium, which is how it was, used everywhere to begin with, and it's pretty quick taming and turning into a broadcast medium, a one-to-many, initially, at least devised as a tool to entertain and to some extent pacify the audience. And it sort of that role amplifies as we go into the 30s. And mm-hmm. and there is a significant change, of course, in the German government.
Yes, with the rise of the National Socialists in the 1930s, you already have in November 1932 another pass at the telecommunications laws, basically, and then a large scale sort of reshaping of the system that's in place. You have a lot of people being fired, being replaced by. Being replaced by people who are more in tune with what the National Socialists wanted to do, and several of the people that I talk about in the Weimar period in the period between the two world wars, who were active as radio producers or artistic directors or authors. Were removed, some of them arrested, some put into concentration camps already as early as late 1933-34 as perceived as types of political prisoners because they were against what the National Socialists had in mind.
And I guess this notion of radio being an interactive medium or a medium that might be interactive from the sense that the listener is moved from passively listening to some sort of active, at least thoughtful engagement, becomes radical, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's this type of idea that the radio would then transition into becoming more of a loudspeaker or a mouthpiece for Adolf Hitler and his government, and a very successful mouthpiece, I think, as well, because by this time the economy had stabilized and they were able to introduce a very inexpensive radio device already in 1933 as well, which allowed the radio to come into every household, so that they had a very convenient way of communicating, one-way communicating their ideas into every living room and parlor in the German nation. And it's not until 1945 that you have a relaxing of that, and then what I like to think is a revisiting of Brecht's earlier ideas about the radio. Brecht is someone that goes into exile very early on in the rise of the National Socialists, and someone who at one point was a very active media producer becomes really someone within Germany becomes someone who is now observing what is going on in mm-hmm. Germany at the time. And one of the really interesting things that I discovered in writing this book was this one very short poem, which he calls an ode to the radio, an ode to the small radio that he was able to carry with him into exile as a type of way to keep track of what his enemies were doing back in Germany. But mm-hmm. he saw in this poem almost as if he was able to, he would be able to tune in exactly what was being said and done while he was being forced into exile.
So what about this subject, which, you know, certainly in English language books does not seem to have been explored much, whereas, you know, obviously, and I guess expectedly, you know, much of the early days of American and English radio is, seems to be fairly widely covered and explored, if not always critically. What about the circumstance of German radio and this experimental bent attracted you? Why did you think that this deserved investigation?
Well, I think initially I was attracted to this topic because I was encountering these radio art examples and the ways in which radio was trying to maintain a sense of identity alongside some newer, quote-unquote, new media types of ways of delivering audio. Such as
so you're talking about audio. Contemporary radio art.
Correct.
Okay.
So I wanted to look back to see what the roots were to how did we – so we have an example in the book from 2003, which is a web-based, radio-based, and live performance piece that really thinks about the radio in different ways. And I was trying to figure out in my encounter with that piece in an online fashion what it was about, what was it that made this radio and not something else? Mm-hmm. And in looking back, I became encouraged and attracted to this idea of radio initially occupying this this very interactive style of communication, that you did have these early amateurs producing broadcasts for each other and responding to each other in various ways. And I thought, well, this is maybe the way in which radio is going to recapture that sense of lost identity that it once had. And so I started looking around for other types of experimental, contemporary experimental broadcasts to try to push the envelope a little bit further. Then thought, well, I need to look at what's going on in the 20s. And found by virtue of the fact that not many of these things still exist as recordings, I found the three case studies that I looked at in the book, and thought, well, you know, this idea of radio practice really needs to be looked at also in the context of how of how it was also being confronted with these legislative practices. And I think telecommunications law, while boring to some, is exactly the kind of thing that I think we're still dealing with today, the world over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a position that we can't seem to dislodge ourselves from.
No, and we're lodging ourselves in it every week here on Media Geek.
Yeah. So I think that kind of became sort of one of the backbones of the book, and I thought, well, let's run with this. And theorists like Brecht and like Friedrich Hitler. So German media theories seems much more robust in some respects than American radio theory or someone like McLuhan. But I think it really brought into play that for an English-speaking audience, that some of these ideas needed to be made accessible to them as well. So that's why I ran with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, you see the seeds of what happened in the 20s and in the teens sort of really sprout again into the 1970s in Germany, mm-hmm. specifically, with an uprising of unlicensed radio, of pirate radio, which I think, also was taking place in places like Italy and had been taking place in the Netherlands and the UK going back into the late 60s. But there's a somewhat different angle to the German pirate radio experience, which is also sort of mated with its some of its bordering regions, bordering nations, say Alsace and such. Then what you had, say, in the Radio Veronica, Radio Caroline in the UK, which were basically commercial radio models at sea in a land that hadn't have commercial radio. This 1970s German example is different and seems to carry that thread a little more strongly to its predecessor. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, there were several stations in the late 70s that began broadcasting as pirate radio, and a lot of them were associated with environmental movements or the anti-nuclear power movement in the late 70s. And this one station that I look at, they're known as Radio Dreieckland, or Radio three, well, I guess I can't really translate it. Which began in 1978. Its first broadcast initially on reel-to-reel audio tape that was then shuttled around to the forested and mountainous region around a small provincial city in southwest Germany, Freiburg in Breisgau, which is located sort of in the three-country region, border region of France, northern Switzerland, and in that part of Germany. So you have this regional approach to radio broadcasting that was really spearheaded by a desire to make sure that their region was safe against any kind of chemical factories or nuclear power plants, and the possibility of any accidents or spills, those kinds of things.
Right. There was a very active anti-nuclear movement at that time worldwide.
Right. Worldwide, exactly. They saw the radio as a really excellent way to communicate their ideas to their supporters, but also to help gain supporters from the sort of the average everyday citizen who may not have been involved with the movement itself, but were still concerned about the health of their children or the health of their livestock or the health of the forests. And so they really did an interesting job of bringing a wide variety of people together from different backgrounds to help support this cause. And the fact that they did it vis-a-vis a pirate radio tactic, I think really speaks to the same type of interesting use that these early radio adopters in the pre-World War I period and into the early 20s were also using.
What they were broadcasting, would this have been an opinion or information that was being largely left out of the state-run broadcast at the time? Do you know?
Certainly. They did everything from broadcasting from maybe a construction site where a new chemical factory was being built, where they were having a protest, so they would do a live recording of the protest, and then this would then be shuttled around to these various low frequency antennas. They didn't have a very large broadcast range, but they would have 10 to 12 different spots where then runners would bring the reel-to-reel audio tape player with them, or the tape itself, and then broadcast via these very small, intricate pirate devices. Mm-hmm. Radio devices.
So they were really trying to avoid detection, and yeah. Also, I think in much the way of guerrilla resistance movements, be able to continue to broadcast even if, say, one transmitter were to be seized.
Exactly, and if one were seized, or if they would then have another 10 in place that, mm-hmm. that would at least get the word out to some degree. But they would also broadcast pieces about other types of social issues. So squatters' rights became an important issue at the same time. And simultaneously, they began trying to actually become legal and trying to fight the German telecommunication system so that they could actually have a legal broadcasting frequency. Mm-hmm. And that took upwards of 8 years before they finally were given the permission to broadcast legally.
And what they were agitating for was non-commercial community radio, in effect.
Exactly, yeah. They were referring to it as free radio, mm-hmm. which eventually would become known as community radio. But then they're certainly not the only example of this. In Germany, you have several. I don't know if I've ever tried to count, but or if it's even possible to count how many there were. But I would say certainly more than 50 to 75 throughout the country, mm-hmm. all also working together, trying to organize free radio in a way that they would have a good organizing voice for the types of political conversations they would need to have to change the telecommunications laws to their advantage.
So how did these – how have these free radio stations developed? How much have they been able to continue in – this same vein and philosophy of a more interactive, two-way like radio.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of them weren't successful in getting their own licenses. The RDL station, the Radio Dreieckland station, was successful, and they've since they are supported solely by, I believe they get a small investment from. Of funds from the state of Baden-Württemberg, where they're located, in the same way that the state-run stations also receive a budget from the government, but they also receive a majority of the funding from subscribers, from people locally who want to see that type of voice available on their radio dials, and the way that they are able to maintain a sense of listener interactivity or engagement is that they provide access to any listener who wants to develop a program.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll have a community, they'll organize their programming in such a way that they'll have five people working on current events and not any one not any one person will become responsible solely for that broadcast, but all five will talk about it in a more egalitarian fashion as to what would become part of that program for any one given week.
So it echoes community radio as it exists in much of the world now.
Yes.
It's an idea which is spread far and wide.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe as we get close to wrapping up here, you can, if you have any final thoughts on reflecting, you know, this history and this continuing thread of radio up now to this modern day in 2009, where at least in the U.S. we have a commercial radio system, which is, I wouldn't say it's on the verge of collapsing, but certainly the large corporations which own them are on the verge of collapse. We simultaneously talk about a crisis in journalism. And I know that's a lot right there, but what we seem to be, you know, if nothing else, be having a little bit of a crisis with regard to our media system and specifically with regard to radio.
Well, I think something that you mentioned at the top of the show about radio and social media, I think that might be one avenue that radio really needs to start exploring in this country, at least more effectively. And I don't know, to some degree, I think the examples that I explore in the book, all the way to the ones from the 1920s up to the contemporary examples, they each seek to integrate radio practice within a sense of a larger multimedia environment. And I think we're doing that to some degree today, but I'm not sure that we're doing it. That might be one of the reasons why commercial radio is failing, because it has been based on a very template style idea of what programming should be.
Mm-hmm.
We can look at the evolution of Web 2.0 applications like Facebook and MySpace and Twitter, for example, as ways in which social media is taking off. But then again, these same applications, social media applications, are moving where they once were sort of the newfangled experimental use of the web. They're becoming much more mainstream,
mm-hmm.
as you get a large contingent of 30 and 40 and 50 something year olds joining Facebook, and it's becoming other than what it initially was. And so that moves these new media into that same commercial vein that a lot of these early radio practitioners and community radio practitioners are trying to keep the radio away from in some respects. I guess for me, it boils down to needing to understand the idea of a medium as something that's constantly changing, that artists working within those media need to always be one step ahead in order to maintain the sense of the experimental. Otherwise, I think we'd be throwing media forms out right and left. We wouldn't still have narrative the way that we think of the book. But instead, what we should be doing is pushing the boundaries of what these media have initially been thought to be, so that they don't sort of become solidified in one vein of use.
So just voice tracked. The same 40 songs repeated
exactly.
all day long,
yeah.
if you're lucky, weather and time, never mind 5 minutes of news. I'm going to put you on the spot. I mean, are you a regular radio listener?
Either
in broadcast, online?
I listen to a number of different podcasts. I have to admit that I guess a typical 40-something radio listener.
Which means public radio?
Means public radio, exactly. But I do go out of my way to listen to some local radio here in the Phoenix area, some community radio. I don't know. I think a 7-year, 10-year process has kept me away from knowing who the players are in the region. But
right.
I think post tenure, I can start doing that kind of exploration. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad the book worked in your favor there. Is there a place where you see this experimental spirit still alive? You know, in a way which you can really say, wow, I mean, there's the still playing with the boundaries of the medium.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think for me in the American context, I still see college radio as being at the forefront. I think to some degree there's a level of training that occurs, but I think college radio is where you have a similar kind of desire to push the borders a little bit that you still do. I think Europe still outmatches the U.S. as far as what can be done with radio.
Mm-hmm. And there's quite a bit more funding for it,
right? There is
in
there
that
is
way
more funding,
as well.
Exactly. But there again, I think you know a funding mechanism is another type of, for me, is another type of regulatory device.
Mm-hmm.
So where you would get funding, you then might have to please the funders in some way. So
right.
So it's all kind of a catch-22, I suppose.
Well, Daniel, I think we're about out of time here. Thank you so much for joining me. Once again, Daniel Gilfillan is Associate Professor of German Studies in the School of International Lectures and Cultures at the Arizona State University. We've been talking about German experimental radio and his new book, Pieces of Sound, available from the University of Minnesota Press. Once again, thank you so much for joining me and sharing this great hour.
Thank you, Paul, for having me. It's been a great experience.
Great, and perhaps you know, you'd like to come back.
That would be great. Yeah, definitely.
as
next book comes out,
or your next paper, or the next great radio or media kernel you happen upon that you can share.
No,
with us.
That would be excellent. Yeah, I'm doing some things right now on the role of memory and sound. So.
Great.
I don't know if that's something that would interest you or not, but we'll see.
Yeah, please. Well, do. Please keep me up to date.
Definitely. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too.